This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. What condition is our wildlife in? For the past three decades, a Virginia-based center has been working to not just answer that question, but to do all it can to help those conditions improve. In the process, a lot of data have been gathered with implications on everything from climate change to national security. There's a continuing struggle to improve human education, too, including efforts to dispel some of the most common myths parents tell their children. So, what would you like to know about wildlife? Any stories you've heard you'd like checked out, whether they came from your parents or not? The president and founder of the Wildlife Center of Virginia, Ed Clark, is with us. Ed's always got great stories to tell himself, but we'll be looking for your input, too, when our conversation begins right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Wildlife is our focus today. If you've got questions about that, observations to share, we've got a phone line for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Our guest is the founder and president of the Wildlife Center of Virginia, Ed Clark. Great to see you back in the Insight Studio.
Tom, it's awfully nice to be back here and spend some time with you and your listeners.
Well, let's start with the basics, if we could, Ed. Remind us just what the Wildlife Center is, why it got started, and how you've evolved over the past 30 years.
Well, it's been quite a process and quite a scenic journey. 30 years ago, there was no professionally staffed facility for injured and orphaned wildlife in Virginia, and really almost none anywhere in the United States. There were four of us who at one stage or another were involved either in veterinary medicine or wildlife conservation, volunteers all. We decided to start a small local organization that at the time was called the Shenandoah Valley Wildlife Treatment and Rehabilitation Center, which is a name that lived in no one's memory, as you might expect, with a name that long. But we started off literally just being a first aid station and a medical facility for local wildlife that people would find. The co-founders included Dr. Stuart Porter, who is down at Blue Ridge Community College in the Vet Tech program, who is a wildlife veterinarian. And in addition to his great expertise as an instructor, his wife, Terry, was a veterinary technician in a zoo. My former wife, Nancy Sheffield, also a veterinary technician. And my background was in organization management, strangely enough, and particularly conservation organizations. I had worked in Washington and actually at the time was still working nationwide as a consultant for various conservation groups. So we started off in a horse barn. And our first month, we took in five animals, and that was more than we really imagined we might ever get. But now we are 30 years into it. We operate from a state-of-the-art facility. We've treated more than 60,000 wild animals, representing something like 300 different species. We've given face-to-face education programs to about 1.5 million people. That's probably a conservative estimate. And now, through our new focus and online delivery of our message, we are quite literally reaching millions each year. That is staggering to us and surprising to many, but we've branched out quite a bit. People who still think that what the Wildlife Center of Virginia does is care for injured animals are seeing the tip of the iceberg, and 90% of what we do is not the most obvious or the most visible aspect of our work.
Early in your career, you were pretty much an activist on all kinds of environmental fronts. Would you say that you're still primarily an environmentalist?
I would characterize myself as a conservationist, typically, more than an environmentalist, simply because of the more management aspect of conservation. Sometimes the word environmentalist gets a negative connotation, not always well-deserved, of someone who is an extremist or a preservationist, if you will. I don't think that's fair criticism or fair characterization, but nonetheless, it is what it is. But the Wildlife Center is a conservation organization, first and foremost. We are not an animal rights group, although animal welfare is certainly something that is near and dear to our hearts. We're not an anti-hunting group, although we do take a very active role in working with state and federal and even international law enforcement agencies to combat illegal activities related to wildlife. So we do hard science, but we do it with a soft heart. So we've essentially got a method to reach all parties, people who love animals and sometimes much more than they love people, but also people who see the world in a more balanced way.
So you started basically as a emergency treatment center, a hospital for injured wildlife.
Correct.
And have expanded in all manner of directions. And the public is invited to come and see what you do today?
Not on a drop-by basis. We are still a wildlife emergency center, a trauma center, if you will. We have four full-time veterinarians on our staff. Two of those are members of the permanent staff. Two of those are there for various lengths of time as postdoctoral students, if you will. We have a clinical internship, which is a one-year postdoctoral training, just like a human medical doctor would do, and then a two-year postdoctoral fellowship, which is very similar to a human doctor's residency program. But our facility, being a hospital, is quite different from a nature center or a zoo. We don't invite people to drop by and see the patients, not only because it's prohibited in our permits, but it's also not in the animal's best interest. We do, however, have regularly scheduled open houses during which the public can come by. But those are posted on our website, and it's reservations only, because the demand for visitation far exceeds our capacity to host and accommodate visitors. So when we post the dates, people had better get the reservations in quickly, because they will fill up within a matter of a day or so.
Ed Clark from the Wildlife Center of Virginia. When there are reservations available and somebody's lucky enough to get one and they come to see your facility in Waynesboro, what are they going to see?
Well, I think a lot of folks come with the expectation that it's going to look like a zoo, and it doesn't. It looks like a very stylish, modern office building, if you will, in the woods. We are a long, low building, and we designed the building to fit into the landscape, not stand out from it. So we've got lots of natural wood grains all around and lots of windows. But essentially, we're a veterinary hospital. And if you have a pet and you've been to a veterinary hospital, ours might look a little more natural in the sense both of the setting and the deliberate attempt to incorporate nature into our design. But for all intents and purposes, one end of the building has office space and a library, and the other end of the building has a veterinary hospital. And it's a state-of-the-art hospital. What distinguishes what goes on there is that most of our patients, well, in fact, all of our patients are wild animals, but most of them are animals people would either never get to see or never get to see at close range.
To you listening to this conversation, is there one environmental or conservation issue that is of paramount concern to you? You're invited to tell us what that is and why. Our phone number here on Virginia Insight, 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Or you can post to us on the Virginia Insight Facebook page. And the only post that we have so far, Ed Clark, is coming from Nancy, who says, "I love all wildlife. Thank you for all you do to help wildlife." I imagine that's not the first time you've heard that.
Well, first of all, you're welcome, Nancy. Thank you for the kind words. But we do hear that quite a lot. One of the things that's very important to us at the Wildlife Center, not only to incorporate into our culture as a workplace and a professional environment, but also incorporate into our message, is that we exist because of the support of the general public. We are not your tax dollars at work, and as a rule, and certainly not in the direct care of wildlife on a day-to-day basis. We exist because people care and they donate money. That's what a nonprofit's world is all about. But we are different from many nonprofits, probably more different than we ought to be. But we never lose sight of the fact that when people donate money to us, it's not our money. It's still their money entrusted to us with which to do good work. And then when we do said good work, we do make a point of not only thanking people, but keeping them well aware of how we're spending their money. We have a very active acknowledgement program, and in 30 years, I can tell you that the number of thank you letters that have left our organization, and one goes for every single contribution, whether it's a dollar or $1 million, and we don't get nearly enough of the latter. But every single thank you letter, I personally sign. And when somebody sends a note similar to a comment perhaps like Nancy had made there on Facebook, we acknowledge that. And I personally read each and every one. And I consider that to be an important part of my job.
Ed Clark, in preparation for any discussion here on Virginia Insight, we try to find some pictures to liven up our Facebook page. You know what I'm going to say. Looking for pictures of you over the past few days, Ed, it's been hard to find anything that did not have an eagle posing with you. Well, I'm not sure the eagle knew it was posing, but do you have a special love for those particular birds?
Well, I do for a couple of reasons. First of all, the bald eagle just invokes all types of positive reaction among the American people. And, you know, it's the national bird chosen in 1782 to represent the United States of America. It's an emblem that is reminiscent of so many great and powerful things, be it the military, the screaming eagles, the airborne divisions, the bird on the top of the flagpole. It's just interwoven into our culture. But on a more naturally oriented focus of its importance, it's also the flagship species of conservation. The bald eagle in this country was at the brink of extinction. As recently as the early 70s, as a result of the proliferation of chemicals, most notably DDT, but others. And here in Virginia in 1970, we probably had fewer than 30 nesting pairs of eagles in the entire state. Through the concerted effort of conservation organizations like the Wildlife Center and many of the others with whom we cooperate, endangered species protections were put in place. The Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act was passed. Strengthening of pesticide laws has been an ongoing process, and today we see in Virginia that with the appropriate amount of investment of time, energy, and effort, we can take a species like the bald eagle, bring it back from the brink of extinction, and today we believe there may be 1,500 nesting pairs of eagles right here in the state of Virginia. That represents a truly dramatic turnaround for a species. And it's something we celebrate every time we release an eagle.
888-WMRA Talk is the easy way to remember our phone number if you want to talk with Ed Clark, founder and president of the Wildlife Center of Virginia. We're going next to Marilyn, who I believe is from Dallas, Texas, although I don't know if she's there right now. Marilyn, thanks for calling in.
Hi, how are you? And I have a question for Ed.
Okay.
I'm really concerned. I'm, of course, in a big hunting state, and I love wildlife, and I've been concerned about things I've been reading that relate to birds of prey and having to deal with lead poisoning, and I wonder, as a private citizen, what can we do about it?
Okay, Marilyn, thanks for calling in, first of all, and thank you for the question. I feel a little bit like somebody's been pitching underhanded. This is a question that's very timely for the Wildlife Center because lead toxicity and lead toxicosis, the poisoning by lead, is a problem with which we deal every single day, and particularly as it relates to eagles. More than half of the eagles coming to the Wildlife Center are presented either directly or indirectly as a result of lead poisoning.
Where's the lead come from?
The lead is coming from those of us who hunt. And when we go into the woods to hunt, we shoot a deer, hypothetically, and speaking rhetorically here. And if a hunter shoots a deer, the practice is to field dress it, leaving the entrails of the deer in the woods. Well, those entrails are a delicacy for scavengers of all types, and they will pick it up, eat it, and pick up shards of the lead bullet fragments.
Obviously, there's more to say on this. Marilyn, we've got to pause for the break. Can you hang on for us?
Sure.
Our discussion with Ed Clark from the Wildlife Center of Virginia is going to continue in just a bit more than 1 minute. He is the co-founder and current leader of the wildlife advocacy and rescue operation that began its work 31 years ago. Ed Clark, president of the Wildlife Center of Virginia, is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We've still got Marilyn on the line from Dallas. We're concerned about lead poisoning in birds of prey. Ed, please continue.
Well, as we were saying before the break, the lead that is contained in a bullet is more than enough to kill multiple birds. The thing that was so startling to me, and I've hunted my whole life. I am a gun collector, which seems a little inconsistent with some people's image of who ought to be caring for wildlife. But the bottom line is that I shoot thousands and thousands of rounds of ammunition a year, mostly at targets, mostly on a range. But when going to the field to hunt, that lead bullet that is benign on a target range becomes a toxic time bomb in the environment. And the sportsmen that are out there doing their best to hunt legally and ethically and appropriately have taken hunter safety classes. They've learned that they're responsible for their bullet from the time they pull the trigger. And we're now faced with extending what used to be aware of your backstops until the bullet stops, you're responsible. Now it has to go beyond that. When the bullet stops, you're still responsible. So if you're out even hunting nuisance animals, groundhog hunting in the summer, leaving an animal in the field where it can be scavenged by a vulture or an eagle or a hawk, it's almost certain if that animal has been shot with a bullet that is either all or partially made up of lead components, that there will be shards of lead in that animal that can kill long after the bullet stops moving. A piece of lead the size of the head of a straight pin is enough to kill a bald eagle in about 48 hours. The trouble is it eats it. The stomach juices or the digestive juices digest away the meat, if you will, and the lead then causes the digestive system to shut down, leaving that shard of lead in the body with the lead leaching away with the digestive acids into the bloodstream. And if we don't get these animals very, very quickly, there is little or nothing we can do to save them.
Marilyn, does that address your question, or did you have a follow-up?
It does. Well, then what could we do where we live?
There are a couple of really good things. First of all, this issue, just discussing this issue, has become so polarized as a result of one of the environmentalist groups, if you will, in Washington, very, very ill-advisedly petitioning EPA to ban all manufacture, sale, and use of lead bullets. No discrimination of what type, what use, anything. The petition was ban them all. We don't want any more lead bullets. Well, while they may have been thinking about poisoned eagles, that had the effect of disarming the military and the police and our security personnel. It had the effect of disarming all of us who are target shooters or protecting our home or person with firearms. And it was such an overreaching, poorly written initiative that it turned people who otherwise would support a measured movement into enemies. We need to back that rhetoric off. On the Wildlife Center's website, when you go to the wildlifecenter.org, there's a section that says about the Wildlife Center or about us. And under that is a list of publications we have put out. And one of those is the Wildlife Center's position on lead toxicity. And that talks about what individuals can do. It's a matter of talking to your neighbors, talking to your family members who hunt. If you know someone who hunts and who is skeptical about lead, print out the paper, give it to them. We are certainly not anti-gun, anti-hunting, or anything else. We believe this problem is real. We document it. We want to do something about it. But it's possible to do something about it with simple behavior changes, simple changes in hunting practice. And that is, if you have an animal in the field, you cover it up or you bury it. So that it cannot be seen, the remains cannot be seen from above, so that avian scavengers, which are finding it by sight, not smell in most situations, so they don't see it and they don't become exposed.
So you're not looking for people to harvest their bullets or the remains of their ammunition. You want them simply to bury the animal or remains of the animal that they killed.
Well, some of these shards are so tiny that it would be, without X-ray equipment, you'll never know it's there. And, any of us who have ever had wild food, wild meat, venison, whatever, or ducks or whatever that have been harvested by hunters, every now and then you'll bite down on a pellet. Don't swallow it is all I can advise you. But the truth is that there are non-lead alternatives now. Back in the 90s, we banned lead shot for waterfowl hunting because 4 million waterfowl were dying a year from lead poisoning because they were eating it, thinking it was grit or seed. Now we have new testing capabilities. It's not a new problem. It's an old, old problem. We just now have new ways to quantify it and identify it.
Marilyn, thank you so very much for such a great question. Somewhere in our audience right now is someone who's, well, understanding of and concerns about wildlife and the environment were radically altered because of some personal experience they had. If you are that person and you'd be willing to share your story, please do give us a call at 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825, or reach us through Facebook at WMRA's Virginia Insight. We're starting to get some more posts on Facebook now, Ed Clark, from people who apparently know a fair amount about your work. We've got somebody here who's got a question for you that was on my list, but let's put it in Ann's words. Ann says, my favorite Virginia treasure. Oh, Ed, you are my favorite Virginia treasure. How are things looking for the black bear pen?
Well, the black bear pen.
By the way, in my question, I was not going to call you a treasure, but I'm
certainly one of the better known antiques of Virginia, I suppose. But the black bear pen reference there is a new facility that is on the drawing board at the Wildlife Center, and we'll be making more formal announcements in the near future once the construction permits have been issued. But in general terms, we are partnering with the Department of Game and Inland Fisheries, our state wildlife agency, to build a state-of-the-art facility in which orphaned young black bears that have been injured can be kept in an appropriate natural environment until they are able to go back to the wild and live on their own as independent, normally functioning black bears.
And this is a fairly huge facility.
This will be a very large facility, and it's going to cost in the neighborhood of $400,000. So it's not only large, it's very expensive. And honestly, it's much more than just a rearing facility. I mean, we just could not justify that kind of an investment if all we were to do there was raise 20 or 30 black bear cubs every year. That's a lot of money. What we will be doing as well, and what makes this facility so different from others, is that it's going to be a true state-of-the-art facility where we can monitor the animals remotely. We will have a fiber optic network that's actually already installed throughout the rest of the Wildlife Center's animal holding compound that will connect this facility to our streaming video. So we will have very high-resolution cameras that we can steer, direct, focus, zoom remotely. And it will enable us not only to watch the development of the animals, watch their behavior, monitor their welfare and well-being, but also use it as an extremely powerful education and engagement tool for the general public. People anywhere in the world, once this is going, will literally be able to log on and watch what's happening with these bears in this pen. And it should be fascinating.
You've already taken some care of some injured and orphaned black bears over the past couple of years. Was that because part of the facility's already been built, or is this a completely new project?
No, this is a completely new project. The Wildlife Center's been caring for bears since way back in the 80s when we first got started, or shortly after we first got started. We have a bear building. But that building is for short-term housing. Typically, we don't like to keep a bear in there more than about 90 days because it's basically just a big concrete block cell. And these animals don't have windows. They don't have an awful lot of access to any type of exterior stimulation. But then again, we don't want them to because almost all the bears in there are severely injured.
But the new facility is going to be in the woods. Huge fenced in over
going
a couple of acres.
Going right up the side of the mountain. Literally, it will be an area of oak forest that has very dense laurel thickets and lots of rocks and logs and limbs and acorns and all the natural things that are in prime black bear habitat. These small animals will go in here, assuming they have no catastrophic or significant injuries. They'll be of course, all quarantined before that to be sure that they're parasite-free and disease-free. But then they will essentially spend their time with other bears, learning to be bears, learning to interact with bears. Very, very difficult to hand raise an apex predator like a bear, even though our black bear is as much scavenger and omnivore as predator. But an animal that eventually could weigh 700 pounds, you don't want them being used to people or unafraid of humans. And that's what this facility will enable us to do that we haven't been able to do thus far. So,
and how long before it will be online?
Well, assuming that the permits, which have the process is now almost a month underway, we should be hearing from the Forest Service in the very near future about the construction permits. We have very high confidence that we'll get them, but we can't really do anything until we do. But once we break ground, we expect to have the facility operational in about 90 days. So we expect to have bears in this facility before this this cub season is behind us.
And thank you for the question and for wording it so much better than I could have. Let's go next to Harrisonburg. This is Charlie. Charlie, your question or comment for Ed Clark from the Wildlife Center of Virginia, please.
Hello, Ed. I had the opportunity to visit your facility probably 10 years ago, and I was very favorably impressed with the facility and the fact that you have done geothermal to help, I'm sure, save you a lot of money and preserve the environment. My question is, in your past 30 years, what changes with science being as clear as it is on what it is and what's going on? What's your experience of climate change in the area?
Well, that's a good question, a powerful question. I'm glad you got a chance to visit the center. The investment of geothermal energy in the new building was really an experiment on our part, but Virginia Power, Dominion Virginia Power, helped us get that installed and get it operational, and quite literally it has been a case study worldwide. But to your question of climate change, we have seen patterns in wildlife behavior that are at least in part, in our estimation, attributable to the rather significantly changing climate just over the last 30 years. As an example, here in the Shenandoah Valley, when we first got started back in the early 80s, when people would ask when deer fawns are born, we would always just give them the standard answer, from the middle of June to the middle of July, with very few outliers. As time went on, that became early June, then it became late May. Now we are expecting the first deer fawns by about the first or second week in May. And we know from the Department of Game and Inland Fisheries that live fawns are on the ground regularly across Virginia as early as late April. And that is just a dramatic, dramatic change in this reproductive pattern.
There's no question that this is because things are getting warmer?
Well, there is no simple answer. There are plenty of questions, and there are no one-dimensional answers. But this certainly is part of the multiple factors that are causing it. The population expanding is another factor, of course. But we're also seeing migratory patterns change. Birds that used to not be around here in the wintertime are around here in the wintertime. Birds that used to migrate to Virginia in the wintertime don't come this far south anymore. Short-eared owls, perfect example. We used to have a big population of short-eared owls that would hang around Fishersville, Virginia every year at the Expo Convention Center there in Fishersville, and people would come from all over this part of the country to see these birds. And I haven't seen them around. I mean, every now and then one will come through, but not like they used to. They just don't come this far south anymore. And certainly some of this may be cycles. Some of it may be natural order of things. But we have to believe that this sustained change in the pattern and very abrupt change in the pattern is at least in part attributable to the changing climate.
Charlie, thanks so much for your call. Conservation activist, wildlife rescue specialist, professional consultant, and motivational speaker, Ed Clark is our guest. He is president of the Wildlife Center of Virginia. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. And if you want to talk with Mr. Clark, do give us a call at 888-967-2825. Next to Afton Wynn. Thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Hi, Ed. You spoke in the beginning of what most people know that they do at the Wildlife Center is just sort of the peak of the mountain. One of the things you do down there that most fascinates me are the epistemological studies that you do, and as related to different populations and diseases and the waxing, the waning of different populations because of that. And I would appreciate if you would speak to that, and also how the information is being disseminated through professional journals or through the popular press. And also, you said something about military work that you're doing, and perhaps that's black ops. You can't even speak about it. But I think that's a very large issue that other people aren't aware of. They just see fewer shortier vowels, for instance. But when you have a 95% drop off in our, in our bats around here, that is huge, and I would imagine sure. that you're studying that.
Well, we are. And Wynn, first of all, thank you for your call. Thank you for your compelling question that sets me up for the next 2 hours to ramble on. But and unfortunately, we don't have that much time. But truly, at the Wildlife Center, people recognize that we treat one animal at a time. We give them state-of-the-art care. We have a goal of returning each and every animal to the wild as a healthy animal, if it's at all possible. And, of course, obviously it's not for about half of the animals that come in. But one of the more important underlying things that goes on that is much more subtle is that each and every animal coming in is not just a patient, it's a data point. It is a particular case study about something going on in the environment. And by compiling data over time, by compiling standardized information about all of our animals, we are able to then get a big picture of what's happening on a broader scale. Now, this is precisely the same thing that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention do in terms of looking for incidence of human health. The Centers for Disease Control spot the emergence of new disease. They spot epidemic outbreaks, and they are able to literally track back things like an E. coli outbreak, where they can literally track that back to a specific salad bar in a specific restaurant and things of that nature. Now, we're not that far along with wildlife yet, but yet is the operative word there. For the last 8 or 9 years, the Wildlife Center has invested almost $1 million in the development of an online database that is made available free of charge to wildlife care facilities all over North America, and now even a few other countries are using it, through which these wildlife care facilities can collect information on their patients that fits and conforms to the standard template that every other user is collecting.
Is this part of the program that you are now calling Wild One?
It is the program that we call Wild One, and Wild One is an acronym for Wildlife Incident Log Database and Online Network, and it is each and every one of those things. So,
the U.S. military has indicated some interest.
Not only indicated some interest, they've made a substantial investment in the development of the system. When we were first exploring the concept, there is formerly an organization here in Virginia called the Institute for Defense and Homeland Security, and it was funded by a technology grant from the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, and we received support for several years to explore the concept of wildlife health as an indicator of environmental health, biosecurity, and possibly an early warning system for bioterrorism incidents.
So people listening can probably make some guesses about why the military would be interested in this, but I'm going to ask you to expand on that, as well as the other benefits of this kind of program. And if you listening want to join in, as Wynn did, we still have a line open at 888-WMRA-TALK. Wynn, thanks so much for your call. We'll continue here in about 1 minute. The co-founder and leader of the wildlife advocacy and rescue operation that began its work 31 years ago, Ed Clark, is our guest, president of the Wildlife Center of Virginia. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. A little bit more answer to Wynn's question about tracking what's happening to wildlife that has, among other things, defense homeland security operations.
Sure. Well, first of all, just to give you a little context, across the United States, there are 5,000 permits issued by state and federal wildlife agencies or other authorities to individuals and organizations to provide care to injured, orphaned, or displaced wildlife. Now, those 5,000 permits actually have a multiplier effect because each of those permits represents about 100 animals that come in to various facilities, whether they're large professionally staffed facilities like the Wildlife Center of Virginia or small home-based operations. It really doesn't matter, but we're talking 500,000 animals a year, wild animals. And recently, there have been a number of scientific studies that showed that the animals coming in for wildlife rehabilitation nationwide provides the largest single data set, potential data set, for studying wildlife health and other things, including climate change, that exists anywhere. And yet, the problem has been that data is unattainable because when it comes in, these animals come into these 5,000 different facilities, they may be writing things down 5,000 different ways. And there are of these 38 agencies that require their permit holders to file a report at the end of the year, an activity report or a report on the types of animals they're getting. No two of those 38 agencies had the same report format. And what we have done is working with colleagues nationwide, and not just wildlife hospitals, but University of Minnesota Veterinary School is one of our very close collaborators on a lot of projects, working with the zoo world, working with federal and state agencies, working with people who are working in epidemiological research. We decided that there was, in fact, a template that would fit everybody. Certain things we need to know about any wildlife incident, whether it's a big die-off, whether it's a naturally occurring problem, whether it's a forest fire, an oil spill, an animal being run over by a car. There are certain things we need to know. And if everybody will just collect information using those standard terms, standard definitions, at the end of the day, we can put all of that information together, integrate it, compile it, analyze it, and get, for the first time, a very large picture of what's happening across the board.
So what is it that you might be finding out as you're collating and gathering and standardizing this kind of information that would interest Homeland Security or the Defense Department?
Well, on a very practical level, there are biological weapons against which our government is spending billions, with a B, to protect us, and against which to develop strategies and defense mechanisms. And yet what we often lose sight of is that each of these weapons is essentially a disease organism. Smallpox, anthrax, plague, Ebola, botulism, tularemia. These are the six organisms that are considered the Category A biological weapons, the ones most deadly, the ones most likely to be used in a military or a terrorist activity, and the ones against which we need to develop defense systems. What a lot of folks didn't think about until we brought it to the attention of the Defense Department, and now everybody seems to be thinking about it, is that other than smallpox, the other five disease organisms, anthrax, plague, Ebola, botulism, and tularemia, are all essentially wild animal diseases, or diseases that can be found in wildlife, transferred by wildlife, and perhaps most importantly, that to which wildlife are the most sensitive indicators. So as an example, if Harrisonburg, God forbid, was ever attacked with tularemia, which is a bacterial toxin, the very first thing that would happen is every rabbit in town would get sick and die, because the most common manifestation of this bacterial toxin is called rabbit fever. And if people find a bunch of dead rabbits, they're not going to call the Pentagon. They're going to call the Wildlife Center. If we know what we're seeing, if we have the presence of mind to notice and document, then maybe we'll think to call the Pentagon or some other authority. But more importantly, our system, our computerized system now, will have the capability to be pre-programmed so that even if we don't notice, the system itself will, which is exactly how CDC operates. If there is a sudden outbreak of skin rashes on a Monday morning in Harrisonburg, the fact may or may not be noticed by the healthcare professionals. Maybe a few people went to the emergency room. Some people went to the Emergicare or walk-in type medical facilities. Other people went to the pharmacy and bought calamine lotion. Other people did certain different things. CDC monitors all of those things, and if they find that a large number of people are presenting a single shared symptom in a very short period of time. They're going to investigate. What they may find is that the Sunday school class had a picnic in the poison ivy patch, or they may find that anthrax has been released in the community, which causes a dermal eruption that looks a lot like poison ivy to begin with. So it's not that everything we find is going to be the indication of a terrorist event, but it's like when the smoke alarm goes off in your house in the middle of the night. Your house may not be on fire, but it's really in your best interest to get out of bed and go look.
Wynn, thank you again for your call. Ed Clark from the Wildlife Center of Virginia. We have this post from Lydia on our Facebook page. She's asking that you talk about the educational, these are her words, educational and sharing opportunities via Critter Cam and the moderated discussion cam in the classrooms.
Well, that it is an appropriate question from Lydia. Lydia's from Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, and very active with the Wildlife Center. And probably her greatest contribution to the Wildlife Center is her daughter, Amanda, who is our director of outreach at the Wildlife Center and truly one of the cornerstones of our effective outreach program. The Wildlife Center is an organization that's very mission-driven, and our mission is teaching the world to care about and care for wildlife and the environment. We are a teaching hospital. Our mission statement, using the word teaching as opposed to teaches, is not even a complete sentence. It's technically a gerund phrase for all of you grammar cops out there. But teaching implies that it's an ongoing process rather than little events. And we are always teaching. People can tune in to the Wildlife Center's website, click on what is referred to as the Critter Cam, affectionately. But there are actually two channels now of streaming video through which you can watch the actual animals undergoing rehabilitative care at the Wildlife Center as they get their strength back. As they, I think one of the animals on there today is an eagle that has come in, came in from Eastern Shore, Virginia. This bird had been found with four other eagles, three of which were dead, one of which was very, very seriously injured. Or quite ill. That one died before it got to us. So it's the lone survivor of an incident on the Eastern Shore of Virginia that's under investigation now. And that's one of those things that I can't talk about too much. But this bird has had a very rough time of it. It was poisoned, we can say that. And now he's recovering. And we hope to be able to return this one to the wild. People get very invested in the case studies. So it's not just watch the cute animal. Right along with it is a moderated discussion group so people can engage, much as we're doing here with your listeners today, asking questions. Tell us about the bird. Tell us about the poisoning. What's the natural history? What are the problems? What can individuals do? How would we know when we see? And we have staff members, myself included, that spend a lot of time online, but we also have a small core of very, very dedicated, unbelievably dedicated volunteers who moderate these discussions, and they compile and inventory our facts and our library of information, and it's a constant educational process.
And Ed Clark, one of the things that I understand that you frequently try to do is educate people past the myths many of us learned as kids,
yeah.
One of which has to do when all of our moms told us if we see a bird fall out of a tree, don't touch it because then the smell of human will keep the bird's mommy from wanting the bird around anymore.
It'll smell the scent of humans and abandon its baby. I mean, I think we can all mouth those words. And we've been trying to tell people that we don't know your mother, so we really are not calling her a liar as such. But no matter how badly you smell, no mother bird is going to abandon her offspring simply because a human has touched it. Common sense, even though it's seldom used outside, so it seems to us at times, it does work. If a baby bird's fallen from the nest, you know where the nest is. Pick it up, put it back in the nest. If the nest has fallen from the tree, call us. We'll tell you how to make an artificial nest and put it back in the tree. The parental urges of wildlife are very, very powerful. And telling a child not to touch it because the baby will be abandoned is child management by guilt trip. It's not biology.
We have this on our Facebook page from Charlotte. Ed, would you explain some of the problems incurred with the feeding of wildlife? And does the problem exist more in rural areas of Virginia due to people discarding garbage?
Well, there are lots of problems that go to that. That, again, is a multifaceted question. Having a bird feeder in your yard, as long as you keep the feeder clean and it doesn't become basically a buffet line for pathogens, it's a fun thing to do. I've got feeders on my deck. I enjoy them very much, and there's no problem with that. The people who say, oh, you're creating a dependency That doesn't really happen, especially with birds, unless there's some other aspect to it. Teaching a wild animal to come and take food directly from a human hand, that is an invariably bad practice. Teaching possums or raccoons or foxes or coyotes, in some cases, to come and take food from humans, that invariably is going to get them killed. Allowing bears to come and, up on your back porch, that's going to be a problem. But really, we have the same nutritional issues that we have with our kids. You know, you feed them junk, they're going to not be very healthy. Throwing trash from your car, that's really a problem. Food waste, you're driving down the road and you drink a soft drink. Hopefully you won't throw the can out because that's litter. But if you're eating an apple, you're going to throw the apple core out. And again, part of the myth is biodegradable. Some animal can eat it. But if you throw it out on one side of the road and the animal happens to be on the opposite side of the road, what you've effectively done is lure it into the highway and possibly to its death. So people need to be mindful. They truly do. Animals don't generally need our food to survive. And if we do feed them, we need to keep in mind that we don't want to be creating a liability for them as we think we're doing something good.
And you also teach people that just because you see a baby animal does not mean you need to rescue it.
Well, precisely. Every adult animal out there started off as a baby animal out there. And, we get the call all the time, well, it's too young to survive in nature. Well, you want to ask the question, well, where do you think its parents came from? You know, they didn't parachute in here as adults. Most of the time when people see young on the ground, particularly young birds, the birds go to the ground from the nest and they are not able to fly. That is natural history. There's nothing wrong in that scenario. And simply not being able to fly doesn't mean that you need to intervene. People say, oh, there are cats in the neighborhood. Well, that is a huge problem in which the wildlife center is actively engaged. Free-roaming cats, feral cats, terrible, terrible toll they take on wildlife. But bring the cat indoors. Adopt that feral cat. Bring it into the house. Make it a pet. But don't necessarily bring the bird in. If you have a question about whether you need to intervene or not, call us. Our office is open 7 days a week. For true medical emergencies, we've got someone on call 24 hours a day. So, if an animal's obviously injured, obviously in distress, that's one thing. But if it's just small, don't necessarily intervene, even though you might love to pick up that cute little animal. You're not always doing it a favor.
Next to Stanton, Steve, thanks for calling in on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Ed Clark, president of the Wildlife Center of Virginia.
Yes, thank you. Hey, this is Steve Talley in Stanton.
Hey, Steve.
And how are you today?
Fine. A great conservationist in Virginia in his own right.
I don't know about that, but Ed, I guess the first part of this for me is just a very big, big thank you for everything you do. You are, without a doubt, one of Virginia's great environmental leaders and probably the country's great environmental leaders. And it's such a pleasure to listen to you talk about these things. I know you've devoted your whole life to it. I got two questions. One's easy, one's a little more esoteric. The first one is, what is the most often treated animal at the center? And then the second one is, if I'm not mistaken, you're a lawyer, and I'm just wondering, looking back, what's the one thing in your life, what event, what happened that led you down this path of doing the kind of work you did? I know that's a long time ago, but tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you're almost right, Steve. First of all, the check's in the mail for all those nice things you said. I am not, in fact, an attorney. I'm a law school dropout. I kept getting accepted and couldn't make myself go, but truly, I have a great respect for the law, and I'm actively engaged not only in making law and regulation, but in applying it both in a regulatory context, but also I do a lot of work with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, law enforcement agencies, and the U.S. Department of Justice, a project I'm working on right now in criminal law as it relates to wildlife. So not an attorney, but what truly convinced me to take the tack I'm on right now is the need to make a difference and the need to really be engaged. Now, as far as your easy question, the most common animals we get are the most common animals that you see. We get lots and lots of squirrels. We get lots and lots of baby rabbits, lots and lots of possums. And while people often ask us, well, they're so common, why do you bother with such common species? Well, we're a teaching hospital. And indeed, we would rather have our students learn on pigeons than peregrines, the basic care techniques. But in terms of kind of going back to your question, I think the thing that has motivated me most is that an individual can make a difference, either in your own home, your own family environment, your own yard, your own community. You certainly are a wonderful example of someone who took a personal passion for water quality and turned it into a terrific career and made a tremendous, tremendous difference here in the Valley and far, far beyond in your own right. But people just need to care and then do something about it. Raising awareness is not enough. We want to change behavior.
Steve, thank you so very much for your call. I'm so sorry that we're out of time. Our guest has been Ed Clark, president of the Wildlife Center of Virginia. Ed, thanks so much for making time for us.
Thank you, Tom.
Virginia Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers, Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And when you go to that page, you will find links to more information about our guest and about the Wildlife Center of Virginia. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.